Welcome to Bookwaves on Cover to Cover. I'm Richard Walensky. My guest is Margaret Atwood, whose latest novel is The Year of the Flood. Earlier novels include Oryx and Crake, The Blind Assassin, Alias Grace, The Robber Bride, Handmaid's Tale. In all, 21 works of fiction, 13 books of poetry, 7 works of nonfiction, and 6 books written for children. Margaret Atwood, this book is a companion volume, we'll call it, rather than a sequel, because it's not a sequel, to Oryx and Crake, which came out in 2003 and I guess was written 2001 through 2003. What prompted you to go back, or had you always intended to go back to the same world that you created for Oryx and Crake, which is a kind of future dystopia?
Oh, yes. It is a future in which much of the human race has been wiped out by a lethal global pandemic, which we find out in Oryx and Crake is actually man-made. What prompted me to go back and tell the same time frame from a very different point of view? Partly all the people who said to me after Oryx and Crake, what happens next? And I didn't know the answer to that, or I would have put it in the book. So I needed to go back and look at that world from a different angle to see, in fact, what did happen next. And the other thing was that for years and years, people had been saying to me, how come you write so much from the point of view of women? My standard answer was, because I'm lazy. But then as soon as I write a whole book from the point of view of a man, which is Oryx and Crake, they immediately started asking me, why did you write it from the point of view of a man? Why didn't you write it from the point of view of a woman? So, in fact, the two central characters, there are three, but two of them are women in The Year of the Flood, which gives us a different point of view again on that world.
Was there any specific incident or comment to you that said to you, okay, this is the book? Because I know people always complain no matter what you do, as you say, but frequently that doesn't turn into a book. What grabbed you, and was there anything specific that grabbed you and said, you know, I want to do this, I want to explore this world?
The world I really wanted to explore to begin with was the green religion in the book, because I felt that it was something that was coming. And in fact, guess what? It's coming. We already have, since I finished the book, we have the Green Bible, which has linen covers, ecologically correct paper, the green parts printed in green, introduction by Archbishop Tutu, various other people weighing in, and a nice list of things at the back that you can do to be a greener and more virtuous person. And in fact, every major religion has had its roots in an attitude towards nature, which was not that developed in the 18th century, i.e. everything's a machine. So Christianity had those kinds of roots. So does Judaism, so does the Muslim religion. The Buddhists have never let go of it, and neither have the Hindus. So it's there, it's coming, it will be among us soon. So I thought, okay, what's it going to be like? What if somebody takes a fairly extreme view of this? What would they be like? What would their theology be like? Would they have music? All religious groups, all human societies do have music. What would their music be like? What kinds of hymns would they sing? And do they have any saints? Well, in the book, they do. Would they have festivals? Would they have special foods? So it was a lot of fun exploring that world.
Before you actually sat down to work on the book, you were already seriously thinking about what that world would be like, what that religion would be like.
Yeah.
Were you writing the sermons and
the hymns?
The hymns at that point?
The group is in Oryx and Crake, but we see it from a distance. And, of course, the point of view of Jimmy in Oryx and Crake is that these people are lunatics, which is usually the view of about small cults with rigid rules when they first start going. So I actually did begin fairly early on, not at the very beginning. I started with the narrative voice of Toby and the other one of Ren, but I started pretty early formulating the kind of theology they would have, because they do attempt to meld science, religion, and nature. I wrote the hymns pretty early on. I've got more.
Well, I noticed on your website that a man named Orville Stober.
Orville Stober got into the manuscript when it was still a manuscript, because he's the musician, composer, partner of my agent in Los Angeles. And he started reading it, and he started channeling the Gardners and writing the music. And he has turned out this music, which sings beautifully by church choirs, pop groups, and others, because we've been doing these events with the music in it, and we've had all sorts of renditions of six of the hymns. He started writing the actual music, although when I was doing the words, I had in mind standard tunes.
You're thinking of a particular tune, and then you're just writing new words to it.
Thinking of a particular stanza form, which is usually 4 feet, 3 feet, 4 feet, 3 feet, ABAB, which is a standard hymn kind of thing, and there are variations on that. But, for instance, you can do a very good Mole Day song to the tune of God Sees the Little Sparrow Fall, etc. You can do that with most of them.
I noticed that you said at one point that you used a little bit of William Blake, John Bunyan, and then actual hymns to create these.
Yeah, the William Blake, of course, was very influenced himself by the hymn form in Songs of Innocence and Songs of Experience. And my Predator Day hymn is pretty much an answer to Did God Who Make the Lamb Make Thee? In the Tiger, Tiger, Burning Bright poem by Blake. The John Bunyan one is that old rouser called To Be a Pilgrim. The others are from the combined Anglican, that's Episcopalian to you, United Church, that's Presbyterian and Methodist to you. They did a combined hymn book some years ago, which I had been going through very thoroughly to find hymns that could be sung at my mom's funeral, and before that at my dad's funeral, hymns that would be suitable for all members of the family, and that was a tough order to supply, because some of them are scientists, some of them are not Christians. It was quite a lot of territory to cover, plus ones that my mother would have liked. And I'm a great believer in singing at funerals. I think it makes people feel a lot better.
So you had actually, a lot of this was
recently in my head. As a teenager, I went around to every religious organization I could possibly get into to see what they were like. I did come out with the opinion that, like Groucho Marx, I don't want to belong to any religion that would have me as a member, but I went to all their services and saw how they sang and what they sang, and how they, for instance, altered old hymns to suit themselves, such as the Unitarians and the Spiritualists, who had their own hymn book. So people are always recreating hymns and recreating inspirational singing, like the old wobbly songs of the 30s. You could call those wobbly hymns.
Well, Margaret Atwood, the book itself, as Oryx and Crake, is realist, and yet it's satire, too. Do you find any difficulty in crossing the line? Do you see a line?
I don't see a line. Of course, my great hero in these matters is Jonathan Swift, who in Gulliver's Travels said, essentially, I'm just telling it like it was. I'm telling plain things in simple language. And then he goes on to tell these whoppers about giants and little people and talking horses.
The reason I ask that is because I'm curious. Obviously, the hymns are taken very seriously. The idea of a green religion is taken seriously.
It will come, yeah. But, of course, then people say, well, some of the people in the religion, they're not perfect saintly people. And I say, well, show me any group of people in which all the people are perfect saints. It doesn't happen. If I make the religion too goody-goody, we're just irritated by it. And if I make it too baddie-baddie, we think it's, okay, religions are bad. I wanted to write it the way I thought it would probably be. You know, people with ordinary people with all of their personality quirks and sometimes inability to get along and mixed messages that they're constantly giving. For instance, I was recently at a funeral at which the presiding church person began by telling us where the washrooms were, and I thought, okay, this is an aesthetic mistake. It's not what you... So those things happen, you know. So my Adam one says, welcome you all, I'm glad you've all remembered your sun hats. And then he goes into a big piece of theology about his theory of creation. So these things are always going to be mixed like that. You walk into any of these edifices and you see, you know, on the one hand, it's the creator of the universe. On the other hand, the kiddies group will meet at one Saturday at 3 o'clock to make paper chains.
And it winds up reading as satire when in fact
it's just
not.
The way it is. Yeah. You know, that's the way these things go forward.
Well, one thing that in 2003 I thought was kind of satiric and I questioned with some of the names of the corporations, Anouyou, A-N-O-O-Y-O-O, HealthWiser. And yet today we have Yahoo and Google, and it's like you've been prescient.
Well, the thing about names is this. You cannot take a name that already exists as the name of a corporation. So the language is being pushed in the direction of neologism by that simple fact. You have to morph the language to get names that are new, that nobody else has, but that are somehow suitable for what you're doing. And Google, I always think of it came from Barney Google with his goo-goo googly eyes. So that Google said to me, great big eyes that are looking. And Yahoo, of course, I'm not sure I would have chosen that name because it is the name of the very unpleasant human beings in Gulliver's Travels. But it's also, you know, Yahoo, like yo-ho.
Right.
Hello. Okay. Be prepared. I'm on Twitter. And somebody just tweeted to me a website that takes you to a new product called Anouyou, except it's spelled A-N-U-Y-U. So it's very hard to invent anything that you then subsequently find doesn't exist. Because if you invent it, either it shortly will exist or it already does and you just didn't know about it.
Well, earlier today, I was looking through Oryx and Crake trying to figure out, okay, where is this taking place? And this mention of a heritage park. So I Googled Heritage Park and
there's
found
out.
There's
a lot of them.
Oh, there's a lot of them.
Yeah, there's many, many heritage parks. Well, I'll give you a hint as to where it's taking place. It needed to be a place where it's fairly flat because the sea has risen and therefore there's all of these offshore buildings that are in fact flooded and they're standing there and falling down and pigeons are nesting on them. So if you look at a map of the coast, we know it's in the east because of where the sun rises. So the east coast of the United States, far enough south so that in the global warming that is upon the world, the crocodiles will be moving in. And there will be afternoon rainstorms in the rainy season. So we look at that, and we look at all the flat places, and I give you your pick. But I would guess it's somewhere around Boston. That would be my guess.
Okay.
It's not that I've always wanted to flood Boston. It's not that at all. They won't have as much snow. In fact, they won't have any.
How far ahead? I mean, obviously, you deliberately keep it vague, but approximately how far ahead of our own time are you writing?
25 years.
25 years, that's all.
Or 30.
Okay.
25 or 30. It's not a predictive book.
The two characters of Wren and Toby, did you find writing from their point of views easy, harder than say, Jimmy?
Jimmy was a lot of fun. And I did test Jimmy out on a couple of male persons of that age to see whether I'd got anything really, really quite wrong. And they did give me two tips, one about swearing and one about how to smoke a joint. But other than that, they said they thought it was pretty accurate. So he was a lot of fun, but he was a lot of fun partly because he was very interested in language and manipulating words. So it's never just a question of man or woman. It's a question of which man, which woman. Who is the character really? How do they think? How do they talk? So with Wren, you have somebody who's actually quite innocent and fairly simpler in her emotional reactions to things. When I first wrote her in about draft one, because this had a few drafts, she was a bit too much that way, so that she became irritating. No, she was, you thought, oh, smarten up. Nobody could be that dumb. That was what she was like then, and then she moved away from that. Toby was always fairly easy to write. Adam won again. At the beginning, he was a bit too irritating. So he had to be pulled back. in that direction. He also had even more complicated theological explanations for things, which got simplified down.
You're listening to an interview with Margaret Atwood, whose latest novel is The Year of the Flood. Adam 1 is the leader of God's gardeners, and Toby is a middle-aged woman who has found herself...
In her 20s, she took refuge with them, but the novel actually covers a time period of 20 years, so that by the time we get to the start point, as it were, year 25, Toby is in her early 40s. She is all alone in the Inuyu spa, where she has locked herself up to avoid getting the pandemic that's killing all around her. And she, therefore, has a vantage point from the top of that building where she can see all around. And Ren has grown up. She's a child in the first part of the timeline. She has taken work at the now government-run sex trade club called Scales and Tails, where they have health benefits and a pension plan.
This book and the first one are basically flashback ruminations on what's happened.
Yeah, it's the timeline is that of the Iliad. Always a handy guide.
Well, why did you decide to do it that way for both books?
Oh, I think I probably just imprinted on the Iliad at some bad part of my youth. I would like to be able, and I have sometimes have started at A and gone all the way through, but other times I start at a dramatic moment. For instance, Blind Assassin, it starts when Laura drives her car off the bridge, and then you want to find out, okay, somebody lied, because immediately you get a newspaper report that isn't true. Why are they lying? Who covered up? And you go on from there.
Some people have said that on some level all novels are mysteries.
I think I said that. Did somebody else say it too? They are mysteries, and there's always something you want to find out. Because if you know it all at the beginning, you say, well, that's that. You know, it's all in the first chapter. I don't need to turn any of these other pages. So they are all mysteries, and there is a lot of opening of doors in them. Quite frequently doors that you, the reader, are saying, don't open that door. There is a lot of opening of doors to see what is behind the door. So we open the doors, we look in, we go through, we find out, and we as human beings just love doing that. We love going around the next bend of the road, we like opening the box, we like peeking through the window, we just are very curious.
How hard was it coordinating timelines?
Horrible, since you ask. I'd like to be able to say, oh, it was a piece of cake, but it's not true. It was actually quite complex, and I did have to draw charts. Yes, and use sticky notes and count months and all of those things that you do. And I do that generally for novels in relation to the ages of the characters to see, all right, if somebody's having a birthday in May, and somebody else already had theirs in February, how old is the first person in relation to the second person? So I do the months down the left-hand side, the years across the top, and then I mark events of historical importance and then events in the character's lives. So I always know, or I hope I know, if I can count on that day, how old the people are when those things are happening.
Did you have that pre-existing chart from Oryx and Crake to start with?
It wasn't any use, because some of the people were different.
God, so how did you manage it? You had to read, I would guess you had to go back to Oryx and Crake and read it.
Yeah, I had to figure out how old Jimmy was. That was the key.
Really?
How old is Jimmy? How old is Jimmy? How old is Ren in relation to Jimmy?
And then there's also Ren's friend Amanda.
How old is Amanda in relation to Ren?
Well, all of these characters, they will intertwine in the two books on one level or another.
They do intertwine. There are a couple of new people who are implied but not present in Oryx and Crake. For instance, Adam 1 is the leader of the God's Gardeners who are mentioned in Oryx and Crake, and in fact they're doing some bioresistance and agitating in Oryx and Crake. And some extreme members of them go and try to let out the chicky knobs of forms of life. He and Toby, well, the God's Gardeners would have to have members. So there's an implied character right there. Bernice, who incinerates Jimmy's footgear in Oryx and Crake, is a character in The Year of the Flood as well. She incinerates his footgear because, not because it is leather, but because it looks like leather.
Was mohair the phony hair animals? Mohair, was that in the first book?
No, it wasn't. It's a new thing, but I think it would be quite good. I offer it to the world. They will now do it now that they know about it, and now that we can code pig's kidneys to be your kidneys, why not code some hair on a mohair to be your hair for the time when you may need it, and you can just transplant it. It will just grow very naturally because it will be, in fact, your tissue.
Well, one example, Margaret Atwood.
Any color, Richard.
Any color.
Yeah.
Well, that changes everything.
Want to be a blonde?
Well, why not have blue hair?
Well, you could have that, or pink, or silver, or purple, or green.
One area where satire, if you want to call it that, suddenly gets very serious. I read the book a month ago, and there are scenes involving a fast food joint called Secret Burgers, and
no one
quite knows what's in them.
No, they don't know what's in them. And what should appear on the front of the New York Times than this awful case of somebody who ate something that was not called a secret burger, but obviously was one, and it did not do her any good.
Well, the entire article discusses exactly where your burgers come from, and suddenly the secret burger, when you find out, you either stop eating burgers or you just don't want to know.
Well, I think possibly you might go to a certified place that is growing organic or traceable beef to put in those things, and you can get that. So that is probably more what people are doing. And in fact, remember the Creutzfeldt-Jakob disease, mad cow disease thing. The people who were going to a certified butcher that could trace where the meat was coming from did not have a problem.
The world that you create, how much of that world is created but doesn't appear in either book?
Yes. Funny you should ask. I do have some things that I could have put in and haven't put in yet.
Are you planning to write a third book in the series?
It's very, very bad luck to say you're planning anything.
So let me put it this way.
If I were to be planning something,
right,
the answer would be yes. But since I don't really ever predict anything I'm going to do in the future because it's bad luck, we'll say, let's wait and see.
In terms of that, would you take us further in the story, or would we be looking back on the world again from yet another perspective? Or haven't you decided?
Both are possible. Both are possible, and you can do both. And then, Odysseus.
The problem, I guess, with that is that when you're spending over 10 years in the same world, there's all other materials to go to in our world as well. There's more stories to tell that are not speculative fiction.
You mean I could be writing some other novel instead of writing this?
That's correct.
I could be. In between Oryx and Crake and Year of the Flood, I did, in fact, write three other books.
Is the Penelopeiad
four other books.
Okay.
Me.
The Penelopeiad now takes on a new meaning in the sense that here we are going back to the same Greek territory in that book, or the form of the Greek story in that book, as we have in these two as well.
Well, as I say, maybe I imprinted on it. So I did write a book that is a non-fiction book in which I begin at the beginning and go all the way through to the end, and that would be Payback, in which I start with ancient religions and work all the way up to our present day.
You read Oryx and Crake in terms of the development of Year of the Flood. When you reread it and came back to it, and this is several years after you wrote it, did you see anything there that suddenly you said, aha, that's why I did that, or some kind of conscious revelation in the book that wasn't there when you actually wrote it?
Some of the things that were only in development when I was writing that book have since been done. The pig and kidney caper. A lot more other things have also been done or are now in development. For instance, in development now is The Fly on the Wall, which appears in The Year of the Flood, and that is a procedure whereby you put a tiny little nanochip inside the pupa of a developing insect so that when the insect comes out, ready to fly, it already has the little nanochip in it. So the fly on the wall may soon actually be a fly on the wall in that sense. It may be looking at you. Only you will not be able to tell the difference. But somebody's going to be controlling it with the controller. Yes, it's an astonishing new world. But the blend of human and machine has been with us for a very, very long time. It's the Tin Woodman story, which is morphed into cyberpunk and all of these other forms. But, you know, it's increasingly possible to do it, what with artificial hearts. And now they're talking about brain implants to make you smarter, which William Gibson already has in Neuromancer. So part of what speculative fiction, science fiction writers do is look at things that are already with us and push them a few steps further. If you're asking me as a fiction writer, would I have done it differently as a writer? It's a bit too early for me to answer that. I can say that had I known I was going to write another one of these things, I wouldn't have made it so complicated for myself.
Do you think we're finally safe from the Handmaid's Tale future?
No. We're never safe from the Handmaid's Tale future because it's a theme in human history which comes back to haunt us when the conditions favor that kind of an arrangement. So don't drop your vigilance anytime soon.
The world of Oryx and Quake and Year of the Flood, 6 years did pass between the two books. When you're looking at, say, the society as a whole rather than the individual elements, you know, looking from the perspective of 6 years later, you could see which elements kind of faded and which got stronger.
Okay, the really scary thing that has happened recently, and it's not something you're going to think about right off the bat, the injection of government money into businesses. It's really scary because you do not want a meld of government and business. If you have that meld, it means there is no external watchdog, however faulty. There is no external watchdog that can oversee dangerous practices by businesses because the government and the business are one and the same thing. You really, really don't want that.
Well, that's in a way what National Socialism in Germany was like.
It certainly was like that. Just turn the cube around a couple of turns, and so was Soviet Socialist Republic. You know, you get the business and the government being the same, and the person who wrote the book on that was Jane Jacobs. A book of hers called Systems for Survival, in which she spells out very clearly why that's a bad idea.
From the vantage point of being in Canada and watching our healthcare debate, what do you see?
I despair. I despair in two directions. Number one, the Canadians who don't know, who've never lived here, are looking at it from afar and think it's all like the Mayo Clinic, and to say, why can't we have such the super-duper wonderful healthcare that they have in the United States? I despair from your point of view, because how are you ever going to unravel the different interest groups and make your very costly health system more efficient for the people who actually need it, namely people who get ill.
How have you found the Canadian system since you're in Canada?
First of all, it covers you. Second, it does not take all your money away from you if you live in the middle class. It doesn't rack up all of these bills and then stick you with them. It doesn't refuse to treat you if whatever you have doesn't occur on their list of things. There are waiting lists, but there are waiting lists here. It has some very good specialty hospitals that do specific things very well, and it suffers from lack of money like everything else. So we are going to be hit with a big demographic, which is the baby boom. This is going to be a problem for everyone, not just Canada, not just the United States. And why don't we get smart, train a lot more paramedics and nurses to handle things that they can do perfectly well? Why don't we allow foreign doctors into the system more easily, supposing they're already in the country? Why don't we make use of the resources that are there, you know, that could be utilized? And I suppose the answer to that is always going to be special interest groups.
Margaret Atwood, Year of the Flood is about a world of ecological disaster.
Yes and no, yes and no. Some things are flourishing very well. Kudzu is doing well.
You know, I see some of the jungles on Oahu, and I'm going, wow, and then I'm told, no, that's kudzu. That's
yeah, and how do you deal with it? Well, in the future, help is at hand because they have invented a caterpillar that eats it. But it's also taken a liking to carrots.
Once you start putting any invasive species anyway to get rid of another invasive species,
you've
got a third
yeah.
problem.
Well, maybe you do and maybe you don't. You never know. Sometimes you ought to have known. I mean, for instance, cane toads in Australia, number one, were useless for what they thought they were going to do, and number two, they are horrible invasive species. But some are good. Some are good. It's case by case.
The Year of the Flood has a very, very large website attached to it, which deals with environmental issues. How much of that comes from you? And
all of it.
All of it.
Yeah, we built the website. It's not the publishers building it. Myself and a company called Scott Thornley Company in Toronto built it more or less from the ground up. We hand built it. And it was they who told me I had to have a Twitter feed and a blog. And I said, what are those? Now I know because I've got both of them. And they're on the website, and the website has got the whole tour on it, for instance, and it's also got, you can get the T-shirt, you can get the Secret Burgers T-shirt, which has a big smiley mouth with a zipper teeth, and you can also get the CD and the music downloads and all of that kind of thing.
How do you feel about using Twitter, by the way?
Well, I think it's very interesting. In some ways, it's a replacement for the Telegram, and in other ways, it's a kind of different sort of haiku. But we did all the website partly as a fundraiser for the organizations that the tour is done in partnership with. So that's the reason for its existence. And some of the things I'm doing with the Twitter is I'm Twittering people to different organizations that I think they might find of interest.
And the tour itself is not merely Margaret Atwood reading and discussing her work, but it's also musicians, local musicians, performing the hymns.
Well, what we did was, for 20 of these appearances, and not all of them are like that, I did, for instance, a standard tattered cover event in Denver, although I did play some of the music, but I call it the Mr. Potato Head pattern, in which you send the basic potato to whoever has taken it upon themselves to do one of these events. And the basic potato is the script and the sheet music and the CD. And then I say, do it your way. You know, do it however you want to do it. And we did 8 of them in England, and we did a number of them in churches and cathedrals. And sometimes we had the church choir doing it. Sometimes we had other singing groups. Sometimes there were professional actors. In Ely, it was 2 people who worked in the Toppings bookshop and a customer who wandered in off the street, read the 3 narrative voices, and they did it really well. So it's a different look. Ottawa, they did a huge backdrop made of scavenged plastic bags, duct tape, and string, which they lit from underneath. It was like a big stained glass window. Kingston, they did the full dog and pony. They made their own costumes. They made hats out of cardboard. They made their own shoes. It was quite extravagant. You can see it on the website. And in Vancouver, we had 3 woman pop singers who did a combination country and western pop Andrew Sisters interpretation.
And the money from...
At each of the events, the different cities have picked their own sometimes. So in Kingston, it was a community food group. In England, it was all the Royal Society for the Protection of Birds. And in Canada, 4 of them were with Nature Canada. And some of them here are with Air, Land, Sea, which is 3 organizations, 1 for each of those elements.
Well, what's the story behind contests for character names?
Yeah, there are 2 of them in Year of the Flood, and I'm not sure that I'm going to do that again, but an organization will approach you and say, you know, will you allow a name in your future book to be auctioned off? in aid of our organization, and Amanda Payne went to the Organization for Victims of Torture Doctors in the UK. And two of the names in Year of the Flood, one of them was a clean air organization, and one of them was a magazine, literary political magazine called The Walrus. But it gets complicated because you never know who's going to win these things. And then you never know, you know, what, how much leeway do I have? A person called Rebecca Eckler won in Year of the Flood, and she has a column. So she's writing a column about this whole experience. And she said, she's going to make me a crack addict. What am I going to be? What am I going to be?
Margaret Atwood, in the promotional material, there are some questions that you ask. What is happening to our world? And that's one of the reasons you wrote the book. And what can we do to reverse the damage? And most importantly, what kind of we?
What kind of we? Exactly.
Yeah.
And that is probably probably the most important question. Well, one of the things I've discovered on my travels, because we tried to do this tour as greenly as possible, which brought me into contact with a number of different organizations and individuals, there's a lot more activity out there than you might think. So part of the we is all of those people, numbers of them quite young, who are enthusiastically and with great dedication tackling various aspects of the very complex problem that we have. The other part of the we is everybody on the planet, including a lot of people who live in areas that are already being devastated by global warming. They're having droughts, they're having floods, they're having crop failures already. So what is going to happen? What happens when famine really hits? So that is a big problem. I don't know the answer, but I can tell you that there are a lot of people thinking hard about it. The other thing they're thinking very hard about is technical solutions to the problems that we face. And there are a number of companies, organizations, individuals who are coming at the problem from their own particular angle. How to reduce electricity use, how to reduce carbon emissions by reducing the need for travel, how to reskin buildings so that they don't leak energy in such huge quantities. And you can go onto the website of Zero Footprint and look at their building reskinning competition. New technologies such as solar fabrics that are able to pick up the sun from any angle rather than through a flat panel that has to be adjusted to the best flow of sunlight. You would be able to put these on a vertical surface of a building and make your own building into a generator. So it's all of these problems at once, including species decline. Jane Goodall has a new book about that and how people are working so hard to bring species back from the brink. It's huge. There's a huge amount of activity. So the we, I think, would be everybody who's working on it, everybody who's just beginning to think about it, and everybody who's going to be impacted by the changes that we are seeing already starting. Gosh, I've never talked so fast in my life.
In terms of the future of writing, do you fear or accept the Kindle?
I do not fear the Kindle. It is just another way of transmitting and storing stories. It's attractive to travelers. If you want to go on a vacation, you don't want to fill up your now carefully weighed luggage with a lot of heavy books. The Kindle will do that for you quite well. Editors like those devices because they don't have to ruin their shoulders lugging around heavy manuscripts. Is it about to replace the traditional book? No, not yet. And probably, in my view, not ever, or not unless they make some more improvements to it. I've talked to people who have used them. I don't think we can get them in Canada yet. And they say, well, there isn't everything on it that I need. So I think for traveling, quick reading, things like that, it definitely has a place. Is that place going to be the entire book market? No. They're popular in Japan for a very simple reason. Small apartments. Not a lot of space to store a great big library.
You know, I like to look at the books that I have every so often. I like to take them from the shelves and examine
them. And I like that, too. Yeah. And you have better spatial memory with a written book. And you can, of course, stick things in between the pages, as we all do. And I'm sorry to say, write on them.
Enroll a saint. I didn't ask you about that.
Oh, have you done it yet?
No, I haven't.
Well, who do you think might be saintly?
Margaret Atwood, there you go.
Okay, so you go on to enroll a saint. You put in Margaret Atwood, and then you say what I'm the saint of. So it has to have a jurisdiction like St. Robert Burns of Mice. And then you say why this person got to be a saint, you know, for Robert Burns, fostering interspecies communication and understanding. And then you put his saint's day, which in his case would be Robert Burns Day. And then you click and you go to PayPal and you pay $25, you get a download of the scroll, which you can either email to your pal or print out and present it to them for their birthday, and it goes to our conservation organizations. It's a great big birthday card, or a nice little present that you can get. But they should be doing something saintly in of a kind that the gardeners would approve of.
So you wouldn't have a St. George W. Bush?
Well, if you thought very hard and thought of some, he liked dogs. He has a dog. St. George W. Bush of liking dogs.
Margaret Atwood, putting aside a potential sequel or companion book to these, what are you working on now? Do you have any more poetry books or collections ready to go out?
Well, I published this one called The Door a couple of years ago. So, no, I can't say that I have anything else ready to go out right now. I can say that writing this blog is really quite time-consuming.
You've been listening to an interview with Margaret Atwood, whose latest novel is The Year of the Flood. I'm Richard Walensky on Cover to Cover.